We greet you from the St. Pete Yacht Club in downtown St. Petersburg on WMTBLP St. Petersburg. Welcome to another presentation from the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club. Let's go to the podium. Here is J.C. Pritchett, club president.
Thank you for coming today. Dr. Michelle Reed is an education leader. She is an author. She is the subject of a documentary called Waiting for Superman. While we lived in D.C. for 10 years, she was the chancellor of the school systems for our son. And I think that we are grateful to be in our second month since COVID to be meeting as Tiger Bay and have a nationally known and recognized thinker in our presence. So with no further ado, I give you Dr. Michelle Reed, and afterwards, Dr. Nicole Carr will come and lead the conversation with Dr. Reed, followed by the questions from the members. If you're a member of the Suncoast Tiger Bay Club, you can ask a question. And Dr. Michelle Reed, if you Googled her, is not afraid to be in the Tiger's Den. Please follow the policies and procedures that we have for our guests, but she is not afraid or scared to be here today. Dr. Michelle Reed.
Thank you. I'm not sure what the rules are about questions, but you don't have to follow them with me because I'm not shy. You can throw anything at me. I tend to find that in these kinds of discussions that a discussion is really much more interesting. And I know I'm going to sit down with Nicole in a bit to answer some questions. I think that's when the real stuff is going to come out. But I'll just give you a little bit of context before we get started with the questions. Just to give you a sense of my experience in D.C., running the D.C. School Board, and I just want to acknowledge all of the educators and school board members who are here. They are doing God's work. There is nothing harder than being an educator in America today, and in particular being a teacher, I think. Having been a teacher before and then many other positions, I continue to say, and especially because my daughter is a first-year teacher this year, calls me every day crying when the kids are driving her crazy. But I have said throughout my entire career and continue to say that teaching is the hardest job there is in this country. Waking up every day and being responsible for anywhere between 25 and 125 kids and their future is one of the most difficult things that you can be engaged in. So let me give you some background on Washington, D.C. schools. When I got there in 2007, I was named the chancellor of the D.C. public schools. There was a young African-American mayor named Adrian Fenty, who had just been elected as mayor. He was the youngest mayor ever elected in the city and the first mayor ever who won every single precinct in the city in his election bid. So it was very, very unusual. And what he's probably in many circles most famous for was the fact that he says he knocked on half the doors in Washington, D.C. during his campaign. After he won in what was a very surprising victory at the time, because he was going up against lots of established folks, people who had a lot more money and more backing than he did. But what he said his first day in office was, I knocked on half the doors in Washington, D.C. It didn't matter where I was in Ward 8 in Anacostia or Ward 3 in Chevy Chase. Every living room that I sat in, people said the same thing to me, which was, if you really want to fix this city, you have to fix the public school system. Because Washington, D.C. was a city where, as everyone knows, the nation's capital, people sort of flock to the city as young professionals, but the moment they know they're having children, they move out to one of the suburbs because of the school district. And that was the case for many years. So for 40 years, the population of the school district was declining, right? And the charter schools were becoming much more popular, right? Such that by the time that I got there, about 30% of the city's schools were, city's kids were enrolled in charter schools. And this was because the school district itself was one of the lowest performing school districts in the country. It was the only school district that was on high-risk status with the U.S. Department of Education for gross mismanagement. And just to give you a sense of what that looked like on a really practical basis, if you were a ninth grader entering into high school in the city's school district at the time, your chances of graduating from college 4 years after you graduated from high school was 9%. Of all of the city's eighth graders, only 8% of them were on grade level in mathematics, which meant that 92% of our young people were below where they needed to be. And perhaps the most disheartening statistic of them all was about our kindergartners. And that was that, we know that in a school system that's not performing up to snuff, that as time goes on, the kids get further and further behind. For our kids, it was even worse. So when you were a kindergartner who came into the DC public schools, it was expected that you were about on par with other kindergartners who looked like you across the country. So not with the wealthy white kids out in Montgomery County or Arlington or Fairfax, but with other kids who looked like you from cities like Memphis, Detroit, Cleveland. The problem was that the longer our kids stayed in the school district, the further behind they got, such that by the time they were in the third grade, they were far below their counterparts in other cities. So essentially, what that meant was that if you were a kindergartner in Washington, D.C. in 2007, you were almost better off not coming to school every day than you were coming to a school district where you were almost sure to be falling behind. So that's the environment that I created, that I came into. And people thought I was crazy for coming into it. They were like, why would you want to work in that kind of an environment? And I said, well, the good news is the bar is the floor. There is nowhere to go but up from here. So I started my journey, made a tremendous number of decisions that got a whole lot of heat, and from closing low-performing schools to removing low-performing teachers and ineffective teachers, redistributing how we think about resources in the city. Those were incredibly difficult decisions. If you were in D.C. at the time, you know I got a lot of flack for those decisions. But the interesting thing today is that even after all of these years, D.C. very quickly became, during my tenure, within the first 2 years, became the fastest growing district in the country as it pertained to academic gains. And it continues to be the highest academic gaining jurisdiction in the country because of some of the foundational decisions that we made. And we can talk about that in our Q&A because we completely revamped the teacher evaluation system, as an example. We did a lot of things around school choice that at the time were unpopular, that I think were actually very helpful in turning the school district itself around. But I would say that, people ask me all the time, well, so, what is the one big lesson that you've learned? Like, if you could only share one thing with people about your time in D.C., what would you say that was? And I think that everything can be boiled down to one thing. I'll sort of encapsulate this in a quick story. So I was about maybe 2 or 3 years into my time in the district, and I would get some very interesting calls from all kinds of different people. But this particular call came from Warren Buffett. And people from Warren Buffett's office called me and they said, Mr. Buffett would love to meet with you. Do you have any availability? And now, how often do you get to meet with Warren Buffett? Yes, I will go meet with Warren Buffett. So I went to Omaha. Met with him, sat down at dinner. It was lovely. He's an incredibly humble man for all that he has accomplished. And so, you know, he was asking me lots of questions about the different things that were going on. I was explaining to him. He is a D.C. Native. So he, you know, asked me about, well, I went to school here. Is that this still there? And at the end of the meal, he looked up at me and he said, Michelle, I've heard everything that you had to say, and I just wanted to let you know that I think it would be very easy to fix the problems that we have in public education in America today. And I said, super, Mr. Buffett. Could you fill me in on what that is? Because I'm struggling over here. And he said, all you have to do is make private schools illegal and assign every child to a public school by random lottery. So think about this for a minute. If you all of a sudden had the CEO's child, the council member's child, the congressman's child, the president's children, all being assigned to random DC schools by lottery, such that many of them were going across the river to Anacostia every day, I guarantee you that you would never see a faster movement of resources from one side of the city to the other as you would in that circumstance. And I also guarantee you that very quickly you would have a system of excellent schools, right? So that's not going to happen. But what it really said to me was this. As the leader of the school district, I think that every single decision that we make has to be the decision that we would make for our own children. So let me explain how that played out in D.C. So for example, we had for a long time been working on a new teacher evaluation system. The old teacher evaluation system, everybody agreed, did not work. The teachers, the principals, anybody who was involved in the system, the administrators, the school board, everyone said, what we have right now doesn't work, which was pretty much like a checklist. You went in, you might have gotten observed for 5 to 15 minutes, somebody comes, checks the check boxes, almost everybody, 98% of the teachers at that time were being rated as effective, right? And yet so 98% of the teachers were being rated effective, but 92% of our eighth graders were not on grade level in mathematics. Like, there's a disconnect here. There's a problem here, right? So we moved to a system where 50% of the teacher's evaluation was going to be based on the academic gains of their students, right? And how we did that, you have to do it very carefully, right? Because you can't do it on an absolute scale and say, well, you know, this percentage of your kids have to be on grade level by the time they leave. No, because many schools are getting children who are so far below grade level that holding them accountable to, you know, grade level proficiency at the end of 1 year doesn't make any sense. You have to have it be based on growth. We had many teachers engage with us in this process of figuring out how to do it in a fair way. And what they said was, look, we're okay with being held accountable, but it has to be in a way that takes into account all of the challenges that exist. So, for example, if you have a child who was absent throughout the school year a large number of days, or they're entering into your classroom, you know, in March and the test is given in April, how can we be held accountable for that, right? English as a second language learner students, all special education students, all of that has to be factored in to how the evaluation is set up. And so we took all that into consideration. We finally decided, you know what, this is not a perfect system, but it is better than what we have right now. We are going to roll it out. At the time, it was unheard of that student achievement gains would be counted in a teacher's evaluation. So we said, all right, we're going to go with what we have. It may not be perfect, but it's better than what we have, and we are going to learn what works and what doesn't work, and we're going to be committed to constantly improving that. So we rolled this out, much to the chagrin of many folks, and got a lot of pushback with people saying, okay, but let's talk about, are we going to pilot this? Are we going to, you know, roll it out over, what, a 3-4 year time period, right? How is this going to do? And in fact, many of the people who worked for me in my administration said, okay, let's talk about consequences here. So if somebody is not effective or is deemed ineffective in the system, like, shouldn't we spend time professionally developing that person to see if they can improve? And the answer to that question, yes, you want to do that. You want to invest in your workforce. And I said, but we also have to think about this in a different way. Because I had 2 children at the time who were in the DC public schools. And the question that I was asking myself was, if I have a person who I know is ineffective, and I'm going to be placing that person back in the classroom the following year, then I have to be okay knowing that one of my daughters might be in that person's classroom. And let me tell you, I would never do that. That is never a decision that I would make. That is never a decision anybody in this room would ever make for either their children or their grandchildren, right? So these are the kind, but, you know, so people say, well, push back, but is it fair? The main people that this needs to be fair to are the children who only get to go through first grade, hopefully, once. They're either going to learn how to read that year or they're not. And that is largely dependent on the adult who is in front of them every single day. So I made the decision. I would not put that person in front of my kids. And therefore, and look, I know I could okey-doke my way. I could make sure that if it really was my kid, I'd get them put in another classroom because I was the chancellor. The vast majority of parents in this district don't have that ability. And I thought, if I'm going to talk the talk, I have to walk the walk as well. And I have to make this decision on behalf of every single parent in the district. So we said, yes, we're going to implement this. We're going to implement it fully. For people who are ineffective, they will not be allowed to continue in the classroom after that. Another way this played out. So we, in 2009, were in the midst of one of the largest budget crises that you can imagine. I don't know if anybody was in education back in the day, but that was a tough time. Every single school district in the country was cutting budgets. And DC was no different. We knew at the time that we had to lay off about 287 educators, which was a huge loss for us. At the time, though, I said, okay, nobody wants to lay off individuals, and certainly this is not in any way an ideal situation, but if we are going to have to lay teachers off, we have to do it by quality instead of seniority. Because the common practice in D.C. at the time, and the common practice, quite frankly, across the country at the time, was that it was first in, right, last out. And we understood why that made sense for our teachers' union, right? They wanted everything to be predictable and fair. But it was a policy that made no sense for children. Right. So we decided at the time, and we had the ability because we had mayoral control of the schools, to allow our administrators to determine who they were going to lay off based on quality. That caused an enormous uproar in the city. I mean, there were protesters in front of my house. There were people. There were rallies in front of City Hall. Right. One particular politician stood up at a public forum and said, Chancellor Ree, I demand that you reinstate all 287 wrongfully terminated teachers today. And I said, I'll tell you what, council member, you have 5 children, none of whom attend the DC public schools. If you agree to bring one of your children back into the school system and allow me to assign that child to one of these ineffective teachers that we just laid off, I will give that person their job back. If you bring all five of your kids back into the system and allow them to be taught by these people, then I will bring five of those people back. In fact, find any cousins, right, long lost nieces and nephews, anyone that you care about, any children that you care about that you would be willing to put in that situation, I will bring the requisite number of teachers back. Needless to say, he did not take me up on that offer, right? Because part of the problem is that people are all very excited about standing up and beating their chests and making all kinds of proclamations about things and trying to put in place policies that they would never accept for their own children. You can't have your own kids tucked up in a Tony private school or a magnet school somewhere and then talk about what you want for other people's kids. No, it doesn't work that way. If we had a system where our decision makers, our politicians, etc., were required to make policy for other people's kids based on what they would do for their own, I guarantee you we would have a wildly different policy environment in this country, and one in which we were way better positioned to ensure that every single child, regardless of where they live, who their parents were, the zip code of their housing, would all have a much better chance of living the American dream, right? Because right now, the reality is that we do not have that situation. If you are a child who is growing up in a low-income household, in a low-income census tract, the likelihood that you attend a low-performing school is very high. This is not about kids and their aptitude and their potential and ability. This is about the structures that we as society have in place. So if they are zoned to a home school, don't have any choices in the matter for the most part, right? That is low performing, where they are almost guaranteed not to gain the skills and knowledge that they need to be a productive member of society, then how can we call what we are doing in this country fair, equitable, and living up to that dream? We can't. So those are some of the changes that need to be made. I just want to applaud all of the school board members and the administrators that are here today. I know you're living this every day, getting absolutely no appreciation for it, getting yelled at all along, but just know that many of us are out here rooting for you, knowing how difficult the decisions that you have to make every day are, and I think it's the job of everybody else in this room to support them in those endeavors. Thank you.
To have you. I know I personally was well aware of your career throughout your experiences in D.C., and I think a lot of us would like to know a little bit more about the events that occurred after D.C. and your impact and influence over things that took place here in Florida. I think you were sought out as an educational reform expert by policymakers here, and as an advisor, and if you could share some of the things that you think were positive and choices that were made to direct some of the policies we currently have in place, because this is a real opportunity since you were an advisor on many aspects of legislation that are in place that now have come to fruition.
Yeah. So I think, when I left D.C., and let me just say this, over the course of my career, I have made a ton of of mistakes, right? Nobody is perfect, and certainly not me. So I've learned a tremendous amount over my career. And one of the biggest things that I learned moving from the district level into the role that I was in for a little while, which was sort of, you know, advising for folks or being engaged at state level policy, is that policies are important, but implementation and execution are even more important. So taking into consideration what I was just talking about with the teacher evaluation system, we put that in place in DC, and it was extraordinarily successful in many different ways. But one of the key things to realize about that is that tremendous resources came with that implementation. So we had lots of city resources and lots of philanthropic resources that came with it. So it's not just that we said, okay, well, 50% of the teacher's evaluation is going to be based on student growth. We also, for example, put in place something where we had master educators who were experts in the subject area and grade level that they taught, who were observing teachers in the classroom. Those were the people who were doing many of the classroom observations. And why is that important? Because I had so many teachers in the district that said, you know what, I love my principal, he is great, but he was a high school PE teacher, and I teach 3-year-old autistic kids. When he comes in and evaluates me, he's a nice man, not so helpful, right? So when we created this master educator core, we would have a teacher who was an early childhood autism expert go in and observe that teacher, give them very concrete feedback. And when we created that kind of a dynamic, the teachers, after you get over the sort of fear, right, and anxiety of having somebody there, having somebody who knows the craft, giving you really meaningful feedback, people craved that. They wanted it. They welcomed it. The problem was that you can have this policy of, okay, let's have teacher evaluations where, you know, 50% of the evaluation is based on student achievement, and then 30% is based on classroom observations, et cetera. But if you don't have the resources to ensure that it is executed and implemented well, then the policy itself isn't going to make any difference. So that was the biggest lesson learned in that transition was, policies, yes, you need them and they're a good thing, but maybe even not worth doing if you don't have the proper sort of resources to go with them.
So with that then, if I hear what you're saying, that operationalizing this process from the point of policy to implementation really would require a lot more knowledge. But also, I guess then, now that you know those things, now that you've had this as a lesson learned, and I will push back a little bit on the growth model, with so much prior research to it being ineffective in Denver public schools and in other schools where it was attempted, and then to perpetuate it, you know, now that we see the flaws in the operationalizing this process, what would your recommendations be going forward?
So let me just say this. I certainly believe that many districts may have tried to implement a new system. I'm almost guessing certainly did not have good implementation of it, and it did not work out. What I would say, though, is that you have to really understand what in the process didn't work. Because there has been a long-term study by two gentlemen, Wyckoff and Loeb, who actually studied the DC, we call it the impact system. The impact system over now more than 10 years that it's been implemented. And basically what that study has shown is that the evaluation system was incredibly effective in not only ensuring gains in student achievement pretty much across the board, but also in the retention of highly effective teachers. And so the teacher evaluation was one piece of the whole system. Teacher compensation was another important piece of the system. Because what the impact system did was it said, if you are a highly effective teacher, you are going to be recognized and rewarded accordingly. So in the new system in DC, once we put that in place, if you were a highly effective teacher that was teaching in a high-need subject area in a high-need school, your pay was basically double in the new system what it was in the old system. We went from being the lowest paid teaching force in the region compared to Arlington, Fairfax, Montgomery counties, to the highest paid teaching force in the system. So all of those things were necessary in concert to actually make this work and to bear out the results. So I think that one of the things that we have to avoid is saying, well, we tried this in a few different places, it didn't work, so see, let's just throw it away. I think instead we have to look holistically at where did it work, where did it not work, what were the differences, and then can we try more of what did work and see if we can replicate that.
Right, so, and I appreciate the study done and which variables we really attribute it to was in this incredible increase in teacher salary that really factored into the retention. Was it the master teacher mentoring and those pieces, or was it really tying it to a growth model? So I think those are really important variables and great points that you make. I guess my other question would be, in our current climate where teacher retention is so key and so important, and it's wonderful to consider and factor in salary when in, as well as the mentorship and those opportunities. But right now we are facing a shortage of teachers, where at the time I think some districts when these were rolled out were dealing with layoffs. And so now in this current environment, how do you think that folks in this model, there's a risk of ostracizing or punitive outcomes happening from these models and these evaluation types? So
that's why I go back to, I mean, I think that if teachers are being recognized and rewarded, right, through the system, then that is extraordinarily helpful. If the system is set up in a way where it's only punitive, right, there are consequences for those who are not doing well, but there are not better consequences for those who are doing extraordinary work, then you have a flawed system, right? I think that the situation that this country is in with the teaching force, I think, is an incredibly precarious one. Are there some ineffective teachers out there who should not be in front of kids? Sure. But instead of spending our time talking about that, let's talk about the heroes who are coming in to the classroom every day, completely undervalued in the work that they are doing, both by society for the profession that they have chosen, as well as through their compensation. And I will say this, the people who are least accepting an understanding of ineffective teachers are effective teachers. Because the effective teachers are the ones who have to bear the brunt of ineffective colleagues. You have an ineffective person who was in second grade, you're getting a whole classroom full of kids who are below grade level. Now you have to do 2 years worth of work in 1 year. The effective teachers know what's going on. They don't want that to continue in their profession, right? But if it is seen as all punitive and you are not recognizing and rewarding the work, the amazing work that is happening with the vast majority of the teachers in the district, that's where the problem is.
Okay, and I think I'd like to reach out to folks in the audience, given what our time is at this point, to ask questions because I know we have a number of educators in the audience as well as very concerned community members about our education system. So we're going to take them up there.
Again, as we last month, please stand here for a line. State your name, ask your question, and then give us the person afterwards. We're not giving speeches, and because of the global pandemic we're recovering from, I'm not going to run around the room with the microphone. So we're going to line up right here again, as we did last month. First question.
Todd, guys.
He's a former president, so he can do what he doesn't do.
Most of us would agree that San Francisco is a pretty liberal town. But yet on Tuesday, over 70% of the voters voted to recall three members of the local school board. The grounds for the recall, as I understand it, were first, the school board was spending too much time on social justice issues. Two, they weren't reopening fast enough schools because of COVID. And three, there were allegations of anti-Asian American discrimination. My question for you is, did the San Francisco voters get this one right?
So I will admit that I did not follow that at all. So I can't comment on whether or not they got it right. I'm not going to proffer an opinion on that. I'll say a few things. One, on the reopening of schools, as with many things, it's sort of a balance, right? I firsthand saw the effects of kids not being in school every day, and they were very significant. But at the same time, we have a global pandemic happening, and we have to be smart about protecting folks from that. So sort of how do you strike this balance between knowing that getting kids back in school faster is better, but also that saving lives and keeping people safe is equally important? And how do you strike that balance, I think, is an incredibly important thing. And you know, I don't mean to keep beating a dead horse, but resources matter on that front. I'll also say this on, and I don't know the situation about the social justice. I think the mistake that lots of people make is this sort of belief that it's either or. You can either teach, you know, the reading, writing, arithmetic, hardcore academic skills, or you can care about socio-emotional, social justice, but there is no in-between. And that is just false. We know that what we are teaching our kids is important and actually in this country has to be rethought. Is that at the expense of ensuring that our kids have the basic skills and knowledge that they need? Absolutely not. So we have to stop having these conversations on polarized extremes and know that almost every answer that we need to get to in public education is a balanced answer in the middle. Understanding what each side is prioritizing, saying is missing, etc., and coming up with something that makes sense and being willing to tweak and modify that as time goes on. What we're doing right now is not working, folks. What we had done in the past did not work. So being afraid of trying something new because, well, we don't have any data that shows that that can be effective. Well, we have a whole lot of data that shows that what we have been doing isn't effective. So let's try something new. Do it in a measured way. Make sure that the resources are there and be willing to change what is not working about it and improve on what is.
During the welcome, past President came in, Dean Kelly Kirschner, Everett, who were moderating our conversation in night, as Dean Kirschner was coming, can you touch, Dr. Reed, on critical race theory and parental rights and other distractions from of the issues that we have going on in the school system that come up every season, it seems, in public education.
I'll say this on critical race theory, CRT, just like the other topics that I talked about. There is merit, right, to the different opinions on this topic. The bottom line is that the content of what we have taught in our schools needs to change. U.S. history, the content of what we're teaching in literature, et cetera, the content needs to change. There's no doubt about that. There are, in the CRT conversations, though, there are concerns that people have brought up, which I think are valid concerns of, well, are we teaching white kids to be ashamed of who they are? No, the balance is in the middle, right? We have to know that what we are teaching is important, that how we are teaching is important, through what content is absolutely important. Kids need to, white kids who are growing up in America today need to understand the dynamics that have existed for centuries in this country and that continue to exist today. There is just no doubt about it. If we're gonna get anywhere as a society, that has to happen. Can it happen in a way that doesn't say you're bad, you're good, but makes people understand history? And kids are the best people to do this with. I guarantee you, they understand this way better and are much more rational about this than adults are, right? So if we do it in the right sort of balanced way, I think we can get to where we need to be. The problem, again, is when you have these extremes, and that's where the conversation is happening, on these polarized extremes, nothing will move forward in that event. And I feel critical race theory, probably need to change the way that's dubbed, etc. That conversation is a prime example of how the polarized extremes are basically sucking all of the oxygen out of the room and not allowing us to actually move forward on important work.
Dr. Reed, you have done an excellent job in apolitical and everything that you do. People have never. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Beatrice Farrell. I'm a board member of Tiger Bay. I think that you've done an excellent job of being apolitical as an educator. So what is your advice to individuals who want to be apolitical when we're talking about anything education related so that we can really move the needle?
Yeah. I love this question because part of the problem that people don't understand is education is so political. People think that it's not, but it 100% is. So I do have a very specific piece of advice on this. So I'm a Democrat, always have been, always will be. But it was interesting when I was in D.C. because I started having a following of fans amongst Republicans. And so much so that the Democratic Party started, well, we can't have her around. Because the Republicans like her. I was like, wait, what? Are we not supposed to be working across the aisle and trying to figure out solutions? So here's my piece of advice on this. This is a quick story. So one of the reasons why some of the Republicans in Washington, D.C. liked me was because I was in favor of school choice. Was in favor of charter schools, was in favor of a federally funded voucher program that existed. And my supporters thought I was crazy. They were like, Michelle, we think that what you're doing is good stuff. We would like to have you here for some time continuing your work, but you're shooting yourself in the foot with all this school choice stuff because if kids are leaving the system, then the money is following them. You're not going to have what you need to be able to do your work. And I said, no, I can't. I have to be the chancellor for all of the kids in this city. And if I can't give them a high-quality option at their home school in DCPS, then I am not going to stop that family and that kid from taking a few $1,000 voucher and going to a Catholic school down the street if that's better, or going to a charter school if that's high-performing. people have to have the ability to make the decisions for their kids that they feel are going to deliver the best outcomes. So despite the fact that maybe it wasn't to my benefit, right, it was to the benefit of the kids in the city and the families in the city to do that. What was interesting, though, was when we put in place the new teacher evaluation system and the new teacher compensation system, where, again, we were paying the highest performing teachers double the salary of the old system, all of a sudden, we started getting all of these teachers from the charter school system, from the suburbs, applying to DCPS. And I had one business person who was a board member on one of the charter schools call me and said, okay, Michelle, we got to do something. Because we spent a lot of time, you know, professionally developing our teachers, and now we have our best teachers who are saying they're going to go to jump ship and go to DCPS. This is not going to work. We should probably have, you know, us one single consistent system. And I said, wait. When you were pushing charter schools, you said competition was a good thing. You can't only like competition when you have the competitive advantage, and then when the school district starts to do better, now the competition should start. No. It works both ways. So one of the things, and this, I know it's counterintuitive, but by embracing and accepting competition and school choice, it made the traditional school system better. And we reversed a 40-year decline in enrollment in the traditional public schools. We reversed that, and we started to gain enrollment because we became better as a system, and we became better as a system because of that competition. So my point in all this of how do you stay apolitical, if you stay focused on the kids and the families, it transcends the politics. So some of the things that I supported were like, yes, well, it happened to be a Republican issue of school choice, but I drew the lines of where and how it happened. For example, with the charter schools or the vouchers, I didn't say charter schools and vouchers, like, let 1,000 flowers bloom, send the kids wherever you want. No, only if those options resulted in better opportunities and outcomes for kids, and that had to be measurable, because we were not going to have low-performing charter schools out there. What's the purpose of that? You have low-performing charter school, you got to shut it down. This is accountability, right? You can't just have accountability on the traditional public school side and not have it with the choice side. So people love the fact that I was a charter and voucher advocate until they realized that I wanted accountability on that side too. But again, if you focus on the kids, because choice, for choice sake, is not good. Choice, again, if it delivers results, 100% for. And so if you can keep your eyes focused on, again, what's always in the best interest of kids, forgetting politics, right, you may find yourself advocating for policies that sometimes are liked by this side and sometimes are liked by that side, and that's okay.
Kelly Kirshner, Dr. Reed, really appreciate your nuanced conversation today. And yeah, based on national media, I would have never picked you as a registered Democrat, so appreciate that. We do have a vacancy for a superintendent position here. So great sunshine here down in Berkeley. Informal job interview today. School board members here today. So, and going back to your conversation with Warren Buffett, and his idea, well, it might not be the children of senators and presidents and the uber wealthy. Didn't we have something like that with forced busing? And if you look at places like the city of St. Pete, Pinellas County, where we did have achievement gains for over two decades, particularly for students brown, black, and low income, and then immediately when busing stops, everything changes, we have resegregated schools, and we go backwards. And so if we accept your premise that we can't do what Warren Buffett wants, if we accept the premise that, well, we can't go back to forced busing because the parents will revolt, then what is the answer to segregating all of the communities, minority and or impoverished children in those same places and to keep expecting a different and better result.
Yeah. So I think we know this about Americans. You force, try to force us to do anything, you are not going to get the outcome you want, right? I think what we started to realize in Washington, D.C. around this was that we had to tackle a few dynamics. One was the scarcity of resources, right? Like, or the scarcity of good, what was deemed then good schools. And then everyone was fighting to get their kids into these few schools that were deemed the good schools, right? And it was everyone. It was the rich white folks in Chevy Chase wanted their kids in that school. The low-income family of color in Anacostia wanted their kids. What we realized is that families everywhere across the city pretty much wanted similar things for their kids. And so what we found was effective was beginning to really listen to what parents and families wanted, and then creating more of those opportunities for kids. So taking some schools that were not at the time deemed the best schools in the city, but really investing in something like a dual language immersion program, a specific STEM program that focused on, you know, kids learning coding, Chinese language program, things that we thought would have a lot of interest to a broad swath of parents, putting the resources into building that, doing a lot of relationship building with groups of parents all over the city saying, I know that this is not proven yet, but let's take a chance. We've got lots of different parents who are willing to say, okay, we started early, like in pre-K, because pre-K is a good place to start, because lots of kids are like aren't in formal programs, otherwise would be in daycare of some kind. So bringing in three-year-old programs, the parents are like, all right, they're not in kindergarten yet, they're not in first grade yet, I'm not making any sacrifice. I might be willing to take a chance on a new program in a new school that I otherwise would not have considered sending my kid to, because it's got, it, you know, it's Montessori, I like that, or Tools of the Mind, there's some really good, you know, programs. Getting a group of parents to say, all right, we're going to commit, we're going to do this, we're going to take a chance, we're going to believe, you know, we're going to hold the system, the school system accountable to doing that. Those kinds of opportunities we found were the ones that allowed us to start to make some inroads in with folks, to do it in a very diverse way, to engage families from a diversity of backgrounds in the city, and to begin to develop way more programs and develop way more spaces for kids, so it wasn't seen as like we're all fighting for the same few spots.
We've got our last two questions right here.
Oscar Banks, I'm a pastor here in St. Pete, and a member of Tiger Way. You are a truly transformative leader, and that's amazing. And you know, watching you from afar and being raised in Indianapolis, Indiana, and Dr. Eugene White, who like transformed IPS in that area. How do you strike the balance with parents? So I get the politics, I get the teachers, getting them to buy in, but how do you strike the balance with the parents who believe they know exactly what their child needs, but yet have no idea what their child really needs? How do you help them to humble themselves, to understand that there are people who actually study what all children need, and so how do you articulate that to help parents buy in and follow along you with you versus saying, oh, she has no idea what my child needs, and just try to embrace your vision or any transformative leader's vision of leading their community?
Yeah. Well, I think that maybe one positive thing that came out of COVID was parents and basically greater society understanding how stinking hard it is to be a teacher. When the kids were at home all day and halfway doing Zooms, I think society gained a greater appreciation for how difficult teaching and being with your children is every single day. But it's important not to lose that as we are going back to school. I'd say probably the most effective strategies that I've seen on this front. There's a program.
This program will continue on Sunshine 96.7 FM. Those of you listening on Radio St. Pete Online, stay tuned for Top of Mind with Julie Rose.
They educate parents on education reform issues. They're not saying this is good and this is bad, but they say teacher evaluation. Here's what people like about growth models. Here's what people don't like about them. Charter schools and choice. Here's what the naysayers say. Here's what the supporters say. They show data, right? And I think what has happened with that program is you now have a group of parents who aren't just reacting kind of off of instinct or what other people are saying or what their kids are coming home and saying. They're operating from a place of being an informed participant in this, understanding what the data says, how hard it is to enact change, et cetera. And to have that group out there at school board meetings, sometimes arguing with other parents, right, has, I think, created an environment in that district that is much more amenable to change because folks aren't just acting out of emotion or kind of personal experience, but from a bigger picture standpoint. And so I think that more initiatives like that, but again, it takes resources, right? Training hundreds of parents over a 20-week period. They're getting stipends for doing it because it's taking their time, right? All that costs money, but I think it has created a much different environment and a much more fertile environment for change.
Jim Gillespie. Equity and diversity are powerful words these days, and apparently they're going to be powerful words for some time to come. If you give them their full meaning, whatever that may be, doesn't that call into question the fairness of programs like fundamental schools, gifted school programs, international baccalaureate, advanced placement? These programs all have special entry criteria. So how do you know these programs will reach all the people on an even basis?
Yeah, that's a good question, something that has to be considered. I'd say this. Lots of people think that equity and fairness means giving everybody the same thing, and it does not. Equity and fairness means giving everybody what they need to be successful, and what that looks like for different children and different families is very different. So, this is I don't know about the politics here in Pinellas County, but I'm going to say this anyway. So my husband and I, he used to be a mayor, I used to be a superintendent, and in 2016 I said, okay, you have two choices. You can run for a third term or you can stay married. Your choice.
Easy choice.
and since then we've been engaged in things outside of politics and outside of education. One of the things that we've done is we opened a restaurant. Opened a number of restaurants, soul food restaurants. And our soul food restaurants are called Fixin' Soul Kitchen. And we have one in Sacramento. We just opened another one in L.A. I understand that folks here in Tampa want us to open one here, so we will certainly be looking at that. Our concept is a very unapologetically black-forward restaurant. We serve soul food, right? And what is interesting, and if you walk into the joint, you look at the artwork on the walls, you listen to the music that's being played, you look at who is serving, like, it's very clearly, this is a black restaurant, right? I have conversations all the time with people because folks who are not African American come in to apply for jobs all the time, right? And I say, well, You don't have to be black to eat here. You don't have to be black to work here. You don't have to be black to lead here. Clearly, I am not black. My husband always says, you're a black adjacent, so it's okay. I'm not black, right? I am not black. You don't have to be black, but what you do have to be is understanding of what it is that we are trying to accomplish with our restaurant, right? So you cannot be a person who lives in this country and who has seen over 400 years what has happened to black people, African Americans, in this country, and not understand that in order to achieve any kind of equity, you have to have institutions, organizations, and businesses who are solely focused on uplifting black folks. So people will come in and say, well, I don't see color. And I'm like, well, that's a problem here, because here you have to see black, because that's what we're trying to do, right? We're a black-forward organization. And my husband says this all the time. Being pro-black doesn't mean you're anti-anything else. We have to have some things that are focused on uplifting the black community. That doesn't mean you're taking away from anybody else or anything less for other folks. It just means you have to have that, given the history that we've had. You have to have things, again, for us as a business, it's been fascinating to have the opportunity to create an environment that is, showcasing soul food, but our clientele, right, in Sacramento is very diverse. People appreciate that. And being able to have a business that showcases other black brands, if you look at our beverage list, it's all black-owned beverage companies, et cetera, because we have the opportunity to do that, and we think that that doing so as a black-owned business is important. So it's, we don't come into our business and say, we're colorblind and everything is the same for everybody, because we believe that having something that is specific for the black community, one can be embracing of everybody at the same time as it is uplifting for a particular community. And so I think that's sort of the important balance in this, is not thinking that in order to achieve equity, everything has to be the same for everyone. There is a way to recognize and reward, recognize and value different segments of the community, and not have that be a negative.
Thank you. Dr. Michelle Reed, thank our Vice President for Paul Carr. For clarity, March 30th, we are here for our legislative review. Those reservations will be going up soon. April 13th, we're back at the Yacht Club for the breakfast. Charlie Justice, our chair, will lead that. And May 9th, we're at the James Museum again. The executive director of the James Museum is also on the school board. Please stand again, Laura Hine. We'll be back at the James Museum. May 9th, Kelly Kirshner will have our higher education presidents. He'll be moderating. June 7th, we're back at the Yacht Club for the District 13 Congressional Candidates Forum. Kelly Kirshner has several of these tigers, just like our previous presidents also do, but according to the score today, Kelly Kirshner asked the best question. And so, thank you, Mr. Kirshner. Come and receive your miniature tiger in your Tiger Bay mug. Thank you, sir. No, we're over time.
Thank you very much.
And again, for clarity, the St. Peter Chamber of Commerce, the City of St. Petersburg, Pinellas County Visitors and Tourism Commission encouraged Kevin Johnson and Dr. Michelle Reed to make St. Petersburg their home, to move their businesses here, to move here, live here, that there's no comparison, the West Coast with Florida, Sacramento with Sunshine City. And so we extend that offer for you to join us as guests. Thank you again, Dr. Reed, for being with us. Thank you for joining us today. Is there anything else? There's nothing else? Okay, thanks.
Thank you. This is a pleasure. And I had a bunch of questions for you.
You have been listening to a live broadcast of today's Suncoast Tiger Bay Club Luncheon, broadcast live from the St. Pete Yacht Club in downtown St. Petersburg, Dr. Michelle Rhee, the former chancellor of the Washington, D.C. Public Schools, was our luncheon speaker today, our luncheon conversation live from Tiger Bay and the St. Pete Yacht Club. President J.C. Pritchett listed off the upcoming programs. Our legislative session will be coming up at the end of March. Additional programs posted for April, May, and June at tigerbay.org. And we'll be with you for each of those programs live here on Sunshine 96.7 FM and our Radio St. Pete online channel. For now, thanks so much for tuning in to WMTB LP St. Petersburg, Radio St. Pete. From the Yacht Club, we return you to our studio.